Truth seekers, please understand, Mental Dialogue is much more than just a talk show. Each and every Saturday, we communicate with you for two reasons, to dialogue and connect. On the dialogue side, we cater to you intellectual outcasts who feel you have no place for honest discourse on race, sex, culture, and African-American business. On the connect side, we've created a community where you can connect with experts specifically in finance, whether personal or business, and mental health, whether it's trauma or to optimize performance, along with all the other skill sets from other MD community members. Our mission was to create a virtual nationwide neighborhood where African Americans learn to trade ideas, goods, and services through social media, meetups, and this podcast. To become a neighbor of the Mental Dialogue Community Club, please visit us at mentaldialogue.com. We are better with you than we are without you. We can be neighbors even though we don't live next to each other. Hashtag raise the culture.
Good morning to all the truth seekers, intellectual outcasts out there listening. My name is Montoya Smith, a.k.a. Black Socrates, and welcome to this morning's Mental Dialogue Talk Show. If you're a first-time listener, again, I go by Black Socrates, who like to take the Socratic method to these difficult conversations on race, sex, and culture. We are very good at doing, and I have two special guests, one returning guest and one new guest. And actually, I'll start with my special guest co-host, Shaninre Norman. How you doing, Shaninre? And if you will, Shay, as everybody affectionately calls you, thank you for being black with us again, as I like to say. If you will, say hello to the intellectual outcast out there. Give people just a little bit of your background as it relates, as you are directly related to this morning's discussion question and our special guest, if you will. But if you again, say hello to everyone, and thank you for being with me this morning, Queen.
Yeah, thank you for having me back. Hello to everyone out there listening in. Again, this is Shaneri Norman, and like you said, affectionately known as Shay. Everybody calls me Shay. I am the youngest daughter of Mama Tamu and Baba Hekima Kinyama, and I'm just really honored to be here today. I'm always in awe of my parents, and so I'm just going to be listening in, kind of being a co-pilot, you know, maybe interject a question or two. But again, just really, really honored to be here, honored to be their daughter.
Man, I love it. I thought it was a super unique opportunity. Again, you served in this role, as I call, you know, my co-host, Queens of Intellect, and you've been able to support me a few times on the show. So I was like, wow, I want to do this about your mom, and we're about to introduce her, Mama Tamu, as you've already said. And I was like, man, the chance to do it with both of you, it makes it even more amazing as we dig into your story. But thank you, Mama Tamu, for being a special guest on the Mental Dialogue Talk Show. If you will, say hello to the intellectual outcast out there. And if you will, share whatever part of your background you want to give in reference to us having this morning's discussion question and getting into your book, 1148 Lewis Street. Thank you, Queen, for being with us. The floor is yours.
Thank you for having me. And it's a pleasure for me to be here and speak with you guys this morning. So I'd like to say hello to all of your listening audience. And a little bit about me is that I've kind of been involved in the Black struggle for all of my adult life. And certain things happen in life that kind of, you know, changes your life. And I guess my book talks about one incident in particular that altered my life. I just can't even imagine what it would have been like had that not happened. But we'll get more into that as we go on with this talk show. And, you know, I'll be giving a little bit more details as to what I'm referring to.
No, absolutely. We are so glad to have you. As we call this morning's discussion question, Married to the Revolution, who is Mama Tamu? And so often we highlight, if you will, a lot of people in history, if you will, that we highlight, and often there's someone, if you will, quote unquote, behind them that's playing a huge role, if you will, in them becoming who they are. Or we did a show just a few months ago. It's actually been one of our, and I'm glad to say, one of our most listened to shows this year. We did a show on unsung heroes. So for anybody out there listening, If you don't know who Mama Tamu Kanyama is, you're going to find out this morning, if you will. And we want to find out exactly who you are. Again, you have this book, 1148 Lewis Street, A Long Journey, which talks about being a target of COINTELPRO. And just to let people out there know, we're referencing the book. We're going to read from the book. But the goal is not, and I'll say this to the audience, is not to just, in a sense, dig into what happened on 1148 Street. We want to find out, who is this woman? Who are you, Mama Tamu, to even be able to, if you will, be married to the revolution? So we want to explain that to our audience. And Shay, so I'm going to turn it back to you, and we're going to start the way we typically start the show, which is a little unique because, if you will, both of you are, in a sense, subjects of this discussion. But Shay, you've done this before. So when you heard me word the show particularly that way, married to the revolution, who is Mama Tamu? What popped in your head initially? I just want to get that initial thought. And Mama Tamu, you think about it as she says it. I want to hear what your thought was when you heard the title worded that way as well. But go ahead, Shay.
Yeah, I have to refer back to what I said earlier. I think it's interesting. I wonder what people think when they hear me say I'm in awe of my parents. Because we're talking about my mother particularly today, I have to say I'm particularly in awe of her when it comes to her display of love, because you say married to the revolution, but it's so much under that. One of the elders that I really hold in high regard, in Wallamu Baruti, I remember him saying to me when I was much younger, and I've heard other elders say this as well, but it stuck when he did. He said that you find your mate in the work. And when you talk about being married to the revolution, I give so much honor to the love that my mother has for my father, because I believe that was her intro, in a sense, to that type of revolutionary work. Mommy, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the way I see it is, when you have that type of love and that type of connection with someone, you really can delve into your life's work. And like I said, just being married to that type of love, I think her love for the revolution bore out of that. So it's just like, it doesn't just come from anywhere. I know a lot of people are involved in activism, involved in uplifting our community. But I just think when the seed starts from somewhere deep like that, when you really have a connection with someone else, the impact can be felt for generations and generations. And I think that is what we have here.
No, I love it. And so, Mama Tamu, I'll ask you again. I've been reaching out saying, let's get you on the show. And so, boom, I finally have you. But when you saw that this is how I chose to word this show, because you didn't have any input on that part, you was just agreed to be a guest. And so when you heard it as married to the revolution, who is Mama Tamu, what just popped in your head initially when you saw it worded that particular way?
When I heard that, I just kind of thought that was worded that way and picked up from my book because of my commitment to my husband and at the same time my commitment to the struggle and to the brothers and sisters that my comrades. So that's kind of what it just was fitting. I thought it was fitting. But I'd like to respond to Shay's
Oh yeah, go ahead. Please do. Absolutely.
All right. The way she explained it and what she had gotten from it. Well, you know, it's like I didn't just start being me when I, you know, got involved with the struggle. It's like my life did take on a different turn when I met Akima and the Republic of New Africa. But all my life, I heard about my grandmother who made such an impression on me, the way she was able to maintain some level of her dignity and not bowing to the pressures of racism and oppression at that time, because this is a lady who was born, I guess, in the late 1800s. But there was just certain things that she would not do, and she was able to survive and survive well, as I said, with a certain level of respect that maybe mm-hmm. some other people didn't get.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always impressed with the stories that I heard. I didn't grow up around her, but you know, I grew up in Wisconsin, and she lived here in Georgia. But I was able to hear these stories about her, and you know, of course, I did get to spend some time with her, not much, but some time. But anyway, and then the other person that impressed me so much and gave me that slant was my brother. I had an older brother who was a thinker, a really deep thinker, and he too had that slant of standing up and not being, you know, succumbing to the oppressive situations that we found ourselves in. Well, anyway, and as I grew older, and then I had an older sister who she and her husband had become, had joined the Nation of Islam, and that gave me a whole another take or kind of put things together in a nice perspective for me in terms of pride and doing for self, etc. But it kind of brought together and connected the things that I felt and learned from my grandmother and brother. And that whole, the whole experience, my vicarious experience, I should say, with the Nation of Islam, really helped me to grow a lot and feel very proud. But still, I didn't have certain direction, but I had a foundation.
It was in your DNA, basically. It was in your DNA. When you talk about, you know, your lineage of, like you said, your grandmother being able to stand up at a time, as you said, when most couldn't. If you will, Queen, I'm going to jump to a quick commercial. We're going to keep this conversation going, if you will. Sorry to interrupt you there real quick, but I want to get to this
initial
commercial out the way. And we're going to dig into your book and open up to, I see some callers out there on the line as well, so we'll open it up for people in the audience to ask questions as well. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show, where all I ask is that you think.
Are you intimidated by money? While this is a question most people never think to ask themselves, but when forced to think about it, many people realize they have unrecognized fears that truly affect how they deal with money. If you want to learn more about money and the fears that keep you from prosperity, join us for Making Money Matter Mondays, where money meets mental health with personal finance coach Ashley Thomas and psychotherapist Dr. Katrina Pitt. Every second Monday of the month, find out if you're intimidated by money and what to do about it. To receive a link to this free Zoom event, please DM the Make It Money Matter or the Mental Dialogue Instagram pages or contact 404-604-9477.
Welcome back to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show. Again, I'm your host, Montoya Smith, a.k.a. Black Socrates. This morning's discussion question, married to the revolution, who is Mama Tamu? Special guest, Mama Tamu herself, as well as her daughter, Shay, if you will. And so I wanted to jump right in on this book that I love called Target of COINTELPRO, 1148 Lewis Street, A Long Journey, obviously written by our special guest, Mama Tamu. And so if you will, Queen, I wanted to just share a quick passage from your book. Again, I think this will let people know a little of who you are and go into some of your younger years, because you did that in your book. And so I just wanted to kind of share this passage, and let's dig in. It says, you said it was a treat for girls to wear pants because pants were not allowed at school, even in the cold of winter. We were not allowed to wear pants. We could only wear them under our dresses, but we had to remove and hang them in the coat room once in school. One exception was Native American girls who wore pants every day. He said, I developed a positive attitude about, I'm just kind of, again, this is from your book. I developed a positive attitude about life in general. I believed that my elementary school was the best in town and had even brought into the idea that I lived in the greatest country in the world, which was largely based on limited knowledge of any other country. However, propaganda in this country was at its peak during the 50s and 60s, and just as most people, I accepted it all. I falsely believed that America was fair and just for all people, the best place anyone could possibly live. When reciting the Pledge of Allegiance, I believed every word and presumed this was one nation under God, indivisible, with justice, with liberty and justice for all. So I thought it was pretty cool for you to point out your joy in wearing pants and how much you love this love this country. So I thought it was a unique place to start. But any thoughts or anything that sparks up from your memories in sharing that portion of the book, if you will, Mama Tamu?
Yeah, because I was a happy child. And, you know, I thought all was good. I thought my family was just cool and no problems. And I just thought that the world was wonderful. But, you know, of course, as I grew older, I began to see that, the family wasn't perfect. The school wasn't perfect. The world wasn't perfect. But little by little, you know, things happen, and you begin to realize certain things. And in terms of the racism and all, it was not as obvious to me as a kid, because you don't, you know, if things happen in a certain way, that's just the way it is. You never, I didn't know how to process it. And in those situations, like I was in, you know, when the majority of the school was Caucasian and it's just a couple of black kids there in the beginning, it was, you know, I didn't understand. But then as things happened, I began to realize that it wasn't all cool. And I had to wake up and find out how things were. But it wasn't a brutal awakening. It wasn't a brutal awakening. I still thought things was pretty good.
Now I respect
in elementary school.
Now yeah. I respect that. And if I could share this other passage, because I think this absolutely relates to even where we're at today. You highlight this as well. You say, learning about black history was basically a joke in elementary school. I could only recall one short paragraph in our social studies book, along with an image of several enslaved Africans chained together at the neck as they are forcefully marched. Blatantly omitted was information or reference to great achievements made by African people. Young people with absolutely no awareness of ourselves, our history, our greatness, and living in such a racist environment is a breeding ground for self-hatred. Even throughout middle and high school, there was limited information taught regarding our people. However, the cold, harsh reality of increasing racial issues were the most important lessons for us. The rose-colored glasses began to rapidly fade. Undoubtedly, one of the most devastating events in the news was the brutal desecration and murder of young Emmett Till in 1955. I clearly recall hearing adults discuss the events and how it appeared that nothing meaningful was being done as a result. Listening to adults was the necessary impetus for reassessment of my views of this great country of ours. I highlight that passage in particular because I think it's a unique opportunity in 2024 for someone. I'm 50 years old, and in a sense, we learned about that period of time that you actually lived through. We learned about it in our generation through the books. But I think it's an amazing opportunity to speak to someone like yourself who actually remembers the unfortunate murder of an Emmett Till. And I don't know that we do enough of that in today's time. And so that's what made me highlight that paragraph, and definitely wanted to kind of, one, hear your thoughts. And in addition to your thoughts, Shay, this is where I'll bring you in, is to talk about her school experience, in my opinion, is not much different even in 2024. We do have the Black History Month now that started, I think, in 1973. So that's clearly different for us in our upbringing. But I don't know that it's a lot different in the sense of seeing enough of us inside of the public school education system. And so, if you will, Shay, definitely want to hear your thoughts on that part. But definitely, Queen Mama Tumu, just want to bring it back to the fact that I'm able to talk to someone who actually experienced living during the unfortunate murder of an Emmett Till. Go ahead, Queen.
I clearly remember that. That is something that you don't forget. And generally, parents back in those days would shield the youth from so much of the pain they were having to endure. But I don't know why they let us see that picture in the Jet magazine. It's something that burns in your brain and you never forget it. And now that I'm reflecting back on it, it's just kind of amazing that they let the children see it, because they used to shield us from so much of the pain and oppression that they were dealing with. But yeah, that was just such a sad, sobering time. And, you know, every household you went to, everybody was talking about it, and it was just such a devastating thing for us in the whole community. Yeah, so it really, you know, did a lot of to our community.
No, I can imagine. What I always say when I hear and have the opportunity to, in a sense, sit at the feet of people like yourself, for me, it just serves as a reminder of how much we do owe. And that, as a lot of times when we talk about standing on the shoulders of giants, it's in a sense those heroes that everybody remembers. But for me, it's always realizing all of the pain and all of the strength, if you will, of those that we don't know about that, in a sense, pull through to get us to where we are. But Shay, just wanted to kind of hear your thoughts again, just thinking of your mom's upbringing and her talking about how school was for her then. I don't know that it's a lot different for our Black children now. Any thoughts on that, Queen?
Yeah, it's funny to listen to her talk about her being a happy child and things like that, because she made our household very happy. Although she and my father, like she said, were committed to the liberation of Black people from a very political plant, which meant we knew some pretty serious people, she still made us all feel so happy and so loved. And so I talk about that because our upbringings were very different, and largely due to my mother. So my mother was, Mama Tamu was, or she retired from the Atlanta public school system. And with everything that she had gone through, even her story about her upbringing, dealing with Black history, but then you look at her, you know, as a grown woman and a revolutionary and an educator in the public school system, it wasn't going to go down like that, at least not here in Atlanta, at least not here in the public school system where she had any influence. So first of all, from a very young age, I mean, we looked at television shows and things like that, but Mom and Dad always had John Henry Clark or Dr. Asa Hillier, different individuals, not only playing in video, coming through the speakers, but also their comrades, their friends, our family, our extended family. We just had a different experience. So I didn't rely on the school system to teach me Black history. So when you asked that question, I was like, wow, like I had such a different upbringing. I got that from home. But then also, Mom introduced Kwanzaa in the school system. And she could tell you, like, I don't know, she probably did Black history year round. I don't know. But the children who came up under her,
they got
under her being an educator, they got a total total different experience. And she ushered Kwanzaa into the school system.
No, I love it. And what you're saying is something that, for those who don't know, I've been doing this particular, I've been on the radio for, besides on Blog Talk Radio, if you will, but I've been doing this run for 8 years, and for 8 years, I'm always imploring that it's necessary for parents to still supplement their children's education in that way, because our school system, in my opinion, is still doing some. I'm going to read another passage just to kind of bring this home, and we'll jump into something else after the next break. But here's another passage that I think, again, is what is the can be the typical experience, but to your point, Shinire, or Shay, is that wasn't yours, and I'm not surprised that this is exactly what your mom, again, longtime educator, she made sure not only that you had a different experience, but to your point, even the children in y'all public school system had a different experience. But here's something else that you wrote, Mama Tumu, in your book. You said, some black teachers did attempt to teach us about our history and our plight, but the message was not always delivered with positive consequence. In middle school, one teacher of light brown complexion expressed to the class her own version of why our people were so many shades or skin tones. She made reference to sexual exploitation during our enslavement and Reconstruction. She displayed herself as an example of the results of those illicit sex acts, fair skin, small noses, etc. Turning to look at the class, she sarcastically stated, "But the darker ones, well, we all know what happened with them." She laughed along with the children as they pointed and made the derogatory remarks. Being of dark skin tone myself, this was unmistakably African features. I and a few others bore the brunt of their misguided joking. I did not laugh. I sat in anger, wondering why she so proudly boasted about the white blood that had so maliciously and savagely found its way into her veins. Black had been historically perceived with negative connotations. However, since most of my family was of dark complexion, black was anything but derogatory. Mom taught us to love and respect ourselves. We clearly understood that our blackness is our source of pride. I was utterly confused by my teacher's discussion. Eventually, I would come to understand the extent of the psychological damage that affects our people. Self-hatred was alive and well, even though it was not always recognized as such. And so, Mama Tumu, that passage again stands out to me because, unfortunately, there's a, in my opinion, an aspect within our own community that still deals with it in the exact way that you wrote about at that time. Your thoughts, if you will, Queen.
Well, I tell you, I realize what you're saying is true. That's still that kind of mentality is still active in many of our people. I don't know I don't know how to dispel things like that, because it just hurts when I hear people that I know and hear their attitude, and I'm like, I don't know what it takes. So therefore I fall back on each one teach one, and you know, as a young person, you know, we thought we would change the world. But what you do, what I think, is that we do what we can do as an individual. And if you're with a group, But what I'm saying is whatever you have to offer our community, our world, you do that. And you may, you know, I'm like the Baptist preacher, if I can save one soul, then my living was not in vain. So right. I'm saying that in terms of our community, if right. I can touch and help somebody to think, I won't say better, but I'll say to think in a more positive way. If I can help them think in a more positive way, then I'm cool with that. I'm cool with the fact that I didn't change the world, the whole world, but I helped some people to move forward and in a more positive direction. And I will continue to do that as long as I've got breath and can talk.
Well, I would love to offer to you that when you say you don't know how to do it, I think the example that Shay just gave about how, in a sense, you brought up your own household is the way to do it. I think you're a living example, and you have made that type of difference, because I don't want to, when I say that, that this way of thinking is still amongst us, if you will, even in 2024, I do want to be clear that it is far different than I think it was back then, even within my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And we've gotten to a place where blackness is seen more positively. And I would offer the reason that is the case is because of people like you. So I actually applaud and reward the work and say your life example of making sure that you didn't rely, if you will, on the public school system. Again, you being an educator in the school system, you influenced your entire school. But we do know that there are black children that are not fortunate enough to be in a school system with, you know, with a teacher like yourself, and they're not supplementing. It's also just sharing with parents that supplementing can make people proud, like Shay can say, well, I don't even know what you're talking about. That wasn't my school experience. I'm proud of who I am. And I would highlight mm-hmm. that it's very necessary, and you are a living example of what to do. So you've touched more than one soul. Let me say that, if nothing else. We're going to go to another break. When we come back, I will open up the phone lines for the callers if y'all want to jump in, ask questions, and we'll definitely dig into more of your book. But thank you for being with us. You're listening to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show, where all I ask is that you think.
Okay.
What happens when your customers call your business and you're too busy to answer or call them back in a timely manner? You lose that business. Shockingly, 61% of inbound calls go unanswered. But fear not, tchmedia.ai is here to change the game. We specialize in capturing, nurturing, and converting your prospects into loyal customers. With our state-of-the-art communication solutions, no interaction will be left behind. When you miss a call, we've got you covered with automatic, engaging texts that keep your prospects connected and eager to choose you over your competitors. Don't let potential customers slip away. Make the smart choice with tchmedia.ai and skyrocket your conversions today. tchmedia.ai is here to change the game.
Shout out TCH Media for being a sponsor of the Mental Dialogue Talk Show. Welcome back to Married to the Revolution, Who is Mama Tamu? Special guest Shay and Mama Tamu. For the callers out there, if y'all are wanting to jump in, you have to press 1. You can ask our special guest a question or make any comments you've heard as far as her sharing passages from her book, 1148 Lewis Street, A Long Journey. I'm going to jump into another passage to kind of further a little bit of what we're talking about. Again, I think it's things that, in my opinion, to listen to you at this time, Mama, to move, talk about the things that you were concerned about. I'm always still digesting where we at today with some of these things. So you've already mentioned this, if you will, to a degree, but there's a passage where you say, I credit the Nation of Islam as well as the total Black Power movement of that era with enlightening our people. I developed a clearer perspective of myself and my people. I became more conscious of the plight of our people. A couple of years later, I stopped eating pork because I was beginning to focus on my health. Muslim teachers greatly influenced my political awareness too. Growing older, I became increasingly aware of the disparities between Black and white communities as it relates to economics, housing availabilities, employment, opportunities, and other aspects of our lives. I developed a thirst for knowledge in general. I needed to know where we were as it relates to our existence in America. I realized that I knew so little about my history, and my desire for more information was intensified. I was on fire. I recall that in elementary school, our playmates were Black and a few whites. I never considered who we played with. I believe we were always subconsciously race first, but we accepted whoever we had contact with. We were rarely, if ever, exposed to people of other nationalities. There were only white and Black people for the most part. There was one little brown girl, Jerry, who was from the Philippines. We knew that she was not white, and she was clearly not just like us either, but she was readily accepted by all of us. The Black boys all went crazy over her. I want to actually put that in Shay's lap, if you will. Shay, any thoughts to hearing your mom talk about the boys going crazy over the little Filipino sister in their school that they all readily accepted. Any thoughts on that, Queen?
Well, I mean, we are of the same era, so I'm sure my thoughts mirror yours. That still happens. That's still a thing. I think, you know, you can have a certain amount of pride in yourself that will allow you to bypass some of the negative energy, you know, when it comes to black women, being a black woman. You carry yourself a certain way, and some things just don't scathe you. But if you're alive, you and your eyes are open, you can see that many black men prefer, are in awe of, are looking for women that don't look like them.
I've always talked about. Oh, Mama Timmy, did you want to say something? Go ahead, Queen. If you were wanting.
No,
to
I was saying Ashe. I'm just agreeing.
Okay, I just didn't hear you. Okay, yeah, you were just saying Ashe. I heard. I just missed what you said. Okay, no, yeah, and so I want to highlight this again that unfortunately, this still digs into. Again, thank you for the Black Power movement. I think again a lot of progress has been made, but there is still this unfortunate reality. And I personally consider the height of this ignorance was at a time, and I'm glad we don't hear this anymore, but there was a time in hip-hop music, I would say maybe 6 to 10 years ago, you would commonly hear a rapper highlight that they had gotten them a foreign. And the foreign typically would, prior to this period, you were just talking about buying a foreign car or an exotic car because, you know, we value these things. But there came a short period where that term actually related to being able to find a woman outside of the United States that, to Shay's point, was not black. And that used to burn me hot that was a popular saying within our hip-hop culture. And so there are relics of that still being passed. I think we are seeing improvements with the Kendrick Lamar's, just speaking of the hip hop culture, it even being highlighted in one of his early years videos where he intentionally wanted, if you will, darker skinned sisters to be the models in his video. And that became a highlight. And so I feel like that term has died within hip hop culture. And I would even say to a degree, Kendrick Lamar was the catalyst of that. And the amazing album To Pimp a Butterfly, which reminding us, you know, served as a voice to remind us of how beautiful our blackness was. And then you get the Black Panther movie coming along and just adding to that imagery. And so I think that term has died, but it has still unfortunately been a part of our reality. And sometimes in my opinion, we're not always consciously aware of why we would think Pino Sister is, you know, so much quote unquote more, and it is due to self-hatred that is a learned thing, not a natural thing. Any thoughts, Mama Tamu, and then I'm going to jump into another part of your book.
Yeah, I think something like that, we could talk for days about that, because it's, again, like you said, self-hatred. And, you know, that's here again, we just got to purge ourselves and try and, you know, bring other people along with us to get rid of that. A whole thing of self-hatred and trying, you know, respect ourselves and love ourselves. So, you know, and we're working on it, and it's a continual job. We've got to continue to do that and work with each other and be patient with our brothers and sisters, for they know not what they do.
No, absolutely. And here's, as a matter of fact, the next part of your book jumps into what I would consider part of the solution to what we're talking about right now. You said that one issue that I was passionate about was the relationship between brothers from the continent and brothers and sisters here in the States. There seemed to be very few sisters from the continent on campus during the late 60s. It appeared that brothers from the continent associated more with white students than us. And another part, you say, not only were black students on campus seeking closer relationships with our brothers and sisters from Africa, the black community at large was also seeking understanding and cohesiveness. We recognized that we were all brothers and sisters. We highlighted our commonalities and worked toward our unification. So if you would, Mama Tamu, I'm very interested in that dichotomy that I just shared in your book. When you highlighted, like you said, initially it seemed that the brothers and sisters from the continent would associate with whites more, and then there seemed to be, on y'all part, a conscious movement to unify that. So if you just kind of speak to what that change looked like to even unify that, because, again, there was clearly a dichotomy initially. Just want to hear what mm-hmm. that book has sounded like, in your own experience. Go ahead, Queen.
Right. It was like when brothers and sisters, or mostly brothers, would come here, they were immediately, the white folks would kind of gravitate to them. And they were also, many of them have said that they were advised not to deal with the black people here because, you know, we were bad people. In other words, we were, you know, just they just discounted us. And so they, you know, and the white folks would just be all over them. But then there were a few of them who had consciousness enough to know that there was a connection. And so when we would see each other on campus and stuff like that, of course, we would talk. And eventually, you know, some became friends, and then it became a thing where we those of us from here, recognized that, you know, we had to reach out to them because they were like coming here. This is like if you have a company coming to your house, you're going to be the one that offer whatever it is that you have to offer. So, we did. We reached out to them, and a lot of us became lifelong friends. There was a couple of marriages that nice. I remember. But, yeah, it, you know, we talked about our differences because there were some things that were keeping us apart. And when we had that conference that I talked about in the book, we were able to talk about it. And some of them were petty things, but still they were getting in our way. And so we were close enough that we could talk about anything that was getting in our way. And also one of the things that Caucasians often tell foreigners about black people is that our women are loose and, you know, just want to go to bed with anybody. So they had, some of them had that in their heads as well. And we had to kind of straighten them out on that. But
you had to get some straightening, huh, Mama Tamu? You had to get some straightening on
yeah.
that, huh?
yes, indeed. But we it turned out to be wonderful. As I said, it was just a nice time to be around because, you know, like I said, some of those relationships lasted over the years. And that was also during the time when the ships would come in to dock at in Milwaukee. And that gave us another relationship because those brothers and sisters, they were not students, but they were coming in and we would go on the boat and party. It was, you know, it was just a really nice time to share and to get to know each other and break down barriers that they had heard about us and things mm-hmm. we'd heard about them that they didn't like us and we don't like them and all this stupid stuff. But, so we were able to really, really, really do some good positive.
I love it. And that's a bridge that still, in a sense, needs to be built. We did a show on years ago, What Do Africans Think of African Americans? And we were able to bring on some brothers originally from the continent who now live here and that type of thing. And so, and again, love to watch how y'all bridge that gap because unfortunate mm-hmm. reality that still happens is now that we have media that goes around the world, then mm-hmm. there's still that aspect of us as brothers and sisters in America that are still being misunderstood both ways due to what's put in the media. And so in the even on that show, the brothers that were from Africa, if you will, talked about the negative assumptions they had because mm-hmm. mostly what they understood about us as African Americans is what they saw in U.S. media. And then mm-hmm. a lot of times they would have bad experience with black Americans in their initial run-in because especially, I would say, in my younger years, we had these negative connotations of how we saw the continent of Africa. And so we would have derogatory terms like African booty scratcher, or we thought of African as unfortunately as the little, as you know, they would have those, the kids with the big stomachs with the fly, like you, so you had such negative connotations that we would actually sometimes when they would even try to take to our community, those Africans talked about how we would be so negative towards them. So, and that we really, you know, on that show, both sides, if you sit in a sense, were realizing those things came from negative narratives, negative propaganda. And so that actually played into the divide as well. Let's go to another break and we'll get more into your book as well. For the callers out there, if y'all are just enjoying the show, no problem. If y'all want to ask a question or give some thoughts on what we're talking about, please press 1 and we'll let you join the show as well. We'll be right back. Well, all I ask is that you think.
LNG Technology Services, we are your industry leader in aircraft and heavy equipment repair services. In commercial business for over 15 years, LNG technicians have over 150 years of equipment-specific knowledge and are known industry-wide for returning worn-out, broken, and overused ground support equipment back to the user in working better than new conditions. For a service job done right at a value unparalleled in the industry, contact LNG Technology Services at 478-781-4860. Again, for a service job done right, that number is 478-781-4860. LNG Technologies is a Mental Dialogue Gold member and proud sponsor of the Mental Dialogue community.
If you have a product or service you would like to get out to the smartest audience in all of radio, definitely contact me. Go to mentaldialogue.com and contact me there, and you can share your services and goods with the Mental Dialogue community. Welcome back. This morning's discussion question, married to the revolution, who is Mama Tamu? Special guest, Shay and Mama Tamu. And we're digging into her book, 1148 Lewis Street, A Long Journey. You mentioned the Republic of New Africa. So let's jump right into that. And that, again, I guess is part of the stage of altering your life, if you will, as you became part of the Republic of New Africa, from what I understand. And there was one thing from the New African Creed that y'all would take, if you will, that I wanted to, one thing I just wanted to point out. You said, I believe that the fundamental way to gain that power and end oppression is to build a sovereign black nation. And so at this point, what I understand, you're already married to Brother Hakima, if you will, and y'all have decided we need a black sovereign nation. Y'all are doing this in the 50s, and you went to Mississippi. Help me understand, Queen. Help me understand. Now yeah. I will say, it's not that I don't understand. I'm being a little facetious here or whatever. I'm still a little concerned about Mississippi, but to this day, I do know that's where, most people don't know this, that is where the largest population of African Americans still reside in the country. So I do know some of the idea behind why Mississippi, but I still gotta ask, why Mississippi, with its tumultuous history with the Republic of New Africa, say, hey, here's where we're gonna buy land, set up ground, and have our own sovereign nation? I do want to understand. Go ahead, Queen.
Well, let me make one correction.
Okay.
When we went, that was in 1971.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Now, the reason we chose Mississippi is because we weren't looking for easy. Mississippi had presented the more devastating events, if you will, in our history that we knew of. And so, you know, you take that one on. That's the one you take. And we talked about the five states in the South in terms of our land. And so Mississippi was one of those states. And as I said, it was, you know, the most notorious one at that time and probably still is. But anyway, so that's why we chose it. We weren't looking for easy.
Ooh, that's a tough one right there for me. Shay, any thoughts on, you know, just from your perspective? Yeah, you know, I'm Mr. Practicals. I'm still struggling to understand. I respect absolutely what your mama had to say, though. We didn't go easy. And for her, enough said, and I respect it. But I'm still like, woo, Mississippi? Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, no, it's funny when she said it. I think about, you know, what's in my DNA, and I say, dang, I don't really do easy either. But it's like if you're going to make an impact, you're not going to step light about it. You know, if you're going for this kind of, like I said, political move, this bold move, it makes sense. You're already not doing easy. So go all the way in, you know, go for the gusto.
Yeah.
Hey, I respect it. I respect it. I don't know. That's why I land with that one. And I promise you, I'm about my people. I ain't never scared. At least that's what I say. But of course, we love to talk big in 2024. I think they're about to find out you was really about it, if you will, as I get more into this book, if you will. I'm going to share another thought.
And Montoya, before you do that,
let me
just put this out there. You know, I think it's been a popular saying for the last couple of years, you know, you match energy, right? If somebody comes at you with a certain energy, you're going to match that energy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like you have to think about a small group of very serious people who are very conscious about the plight of Black people. And like she said, specifically or particularly in Mississippi, you got to match. When you're really talking about, like I said, making an impact, you got to match the energy that you are attempting to either overcome, you know, or divert. So I just wanted to put that out there. Yeah, you had to match that energy.
Yeah, fair enough. And so kind of jumping back to a subject we were just talking about, again, it was just you highlighting on your trip to Ghana in your book. I thought this was curious, and I would love for us to kind of dig into this broader conversation as well, because, again, I think the beauty of your book, Mama Timu, is that it, in my opinion, gives cause for bigger conversations than just, in a sense, listening to your story, if you will. And so you highlighted in the summer of 1971, you were able to take a trip to Ghana. That's still something I'm looking to do, to take my first trip, if you will, to the continent. And Ghana's definitely on my list, if you will. But I just remember, here's a couple of things you highlighted. You talked about that the only puzzling sight for you was Africans wearing white British style wigs at the time.
Right.
I'll go ahead, jump in on that real quick, and then I'm gonna share another paragraph.
I did not understand it, and I guess it wasn't for me to understand, but it bothered me to see that, but I still don't quite understand it, but it was explained to me some years later why they were still doing that. You know, it was their custom, but anyway, however, I had to point that out because it was something that bothered me.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I can imagine that, especially with you having, in a sense, become, as you said, a part of the Black struggle, the Black power movement, taking pride in our own, and, like I said, being fortunate to take that trip to the continent, again, something I still would love to do, still need to do. So I can only imagine why that was such a sight for you. And like you said,
right,
it was explained to you later. And unfortunately, it shows the unfortunate power of colonization that is still very prevalent on the continent. One of my Mensdala members, actually from Ghana, he constantly speaks about how prevalent that type of mindset is for certain countries where, if you will, whichever country particularly colonized them, and some countries have done, if you will, some of them have done a better job of rooting out some of that thought process. Others have done less. And so he constantly talks about being upset with that still being not only that colonization still having power, even though they have become quote-unquote independent, and how a lot of those governments themselves, like, for example, And it just really literally comes to my mind, the brother that I'm speaking of. I remember one time him being very upset about how when Ghanaian officials, if they have like a major medical issue, that is very common right now, today, that they will be flown out of Ghana over to Europe to be dealt with in order to, you know, obviously be brought back to health. And I remember him highlighting that because he was saying, this is something our government officials, black government officials of Ghanaian descent, gladly do, but yet our people don't have access to that level of health care. And so he, in a sense, is pointing out that they're willing to ride that coattail versus being empowered themselves to be able to ensure that their own people have access to that level of care. Now, clearly, it's not as simple as this is, we just want to do that, but he highlights that willingness to travel outside of Ghana in that situation points out that they're not really about ensuring that their own people okay. He's like, they should never do it out of principle because of what it looks like to the people. Any thoughts on that, Queen, as well as from you, Shay?
What I surmise is that they're no different than we are in this country or in Jamaica or in anywhere else in the diaspora. We still, all of us, still hold on to our slave masters, many of their rituals and their ways. And those of us who have consider ourselves conscious, we're doing a little better than some, but you know, when you're born and bred into a situation after centuries, you're bound to have leftover garbage in there. And just like our people here, you got some of our people here, if you didn't see them, but just could monitor their behavior and their cultural display, you would think that they were Caucasian. The way they act, the way they dress, the way they apparently think, it's just that they're little colored white people, because there's so many of our people are still like that. And I'm saying that to say that that's the way it is all over the world. When, you know, a lot of times, you know, you take on the slave master's ways, and it takes time. Hopefully, you'll get over it, but maybe some of them won't. But those of us who think that we're over it, or we're at least trying to be over it, we have to do that. We have to keep on keeping on and keep on trying to rid ourselves of all of that. And that's on the continent and wherever else. So, yeah, I realize that a lot of them have that, you know, the holding on to the European ways. But hopefully they'll be able to shed it as well as those over here.
Yeah, like I said, my brother Frank Asante, just to highlight that, one of my longtime supporters, you know, he was the one that made that case. And just, you know, Shay, your thoughts on it. To his point, nothing indicates the concept of superior and inferior, by, in his opinion, from that example, then, you know, his point was, are you telling me we don't have any Ghanaian doctors that can't serve you in that situation? Or is that what you're telling me? Is that you as a government official, that's what you want to display to our people with our history? That was his frustration with the fact that they would continue to do that. Your thoughts on that? Quick, Shay, got like a minute before break, so just a quick thought from your perspective on my brother Frank really pressing his country about their willingness to do that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a major hurdle to really, like, refer on what you feel. But oftentimes we make these choices and we follow individuals who tell us to do certain things and act in ways that really don't even feel good. But I don't think we're conscious enough about how we actually feel, right? internally. And so I'll stop there, but that's just a generality around that.
No, absolutely. And so, yeah, it's just, again, it's being aware of how it looks, the propaganda, like a lot of the things that we have been taught to believe that make us feel less than or have the self-hatred, mm-hmm. It all starts with the narrative or imagery. And while, of course, if you are in a medical situation, naturally it's human nature to want to best help, you know, want the best help that you can absolutely get. So I'm not knocking it from a personal standpoint, but to his point, when you're in government and have a responsibility to say, hey, we can stand on our own, then you absolutely in that situation have a responsibility to convey what you need to say, but convey to your own people. As I always talk about, we need to understand propaganda, not only how it was used against us, but how to use it to enforce what we want our people to do, because the narrative always precedes the action. And sometimes due to our own unconsciousness, we're not always being aware of the message that we need to present to our own. And that's why I love that call out from Brother Frank. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show, where all I ask is that you think.
Hey, where did you get that hat and t-shirt? I like that.
Oh, I got this at moneymotivation.com. It's fresh, right?
Yes, and I love the message on it, too. You are the hustle, huh?
That's what the shirt says. I am the hustle. They embody the entrepreneurial spirit, and what I like the most, it's more than a brand. It's a lifestyle for those who want to put in the work and expect to have the finer things in life. I also follow them on Instagram. Check this post out.
If you believe money is the root of all evil, you're using it wrong?
Or how about this one? Excuses made $0 an hour.
I like those. What's their IG?
At moneymotivation.co.
But do they have any ladies' gear?
Yes, you're going to love the clothing line they got for the ladies. Matter of fact, pull up their website, moneymotivation.com, and I'm going to get you a few things so we can both look like money.
Everywhere I go, and everywhere I be, I don't even talk, they still know it's me. Cause I look like money, smell like money, talk like money, even walk like money.
Welcome back to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show. I'm your host, Montoya Smith, a.k.a. Black Socrates. This morning's discussion, Married to the Revolution, Who is Mama Tamu? Special guest, Mama Tamu, as well as her daughter, Shay, and we're digging into her book, 1148 Lewis Street, to continue the conversation, not to just talk specifically and only negatively about gun. I want to highlight something that you wrote in the book as well. You says, my group and I got along with the Ghanaian students. However, it became apparent that some continental Africans knew little or nothing about the history of Africans in America. They had no knowledge of the extent of pain and suffering that we had endured or the reality of our struggles today. A popular belief among a few was that we were all financially wealthy and that we should be grateful to be Americans. On the other hand, there were many students who we connected with on our global issues as African people. One of my professors at UWM, before our trip, personally recommended that I not go over there talking politics. However, we engaged in numerous serious political discussions regarding the plight of our people, our history, and expectations for the future. A momentous trip indeed. I love you pointing it out in the book, Mama Tamu. I would offer that I don't know that we now or care about bridging the gap enough, even in 2024. In general, I'm generalizing here. Again, it's very important to some people. We definitely try to bridge that gap inside of the Mental Dialogue Community Club. So I'm not saying nobody's doing it, but I feel like the capacity to bridge that gap, even in the manner that you just mentioned, to negate some of the stereotypes that still exist. Those stereotypes, as you said, this trip is 1971, are still there. When we did the show with the brothers on the Africans on the show, talking about the aspect of those who have been fortunate enough to travel, and there are still people who say, oh, you're American, and there's assumption of wealth based on how the United States presents itself as a wealthy country. So all these type of things that are still existed, because I don't know that we have the capacity or even the want to to bridge the gap because I don't know that we think it is necessary. I'm not saying I'm right, but I want to hear your thoughts on that, Mama Tamu.
Well, let me refer back to when I was there, how some of the students reacted to us. There were some who, again, who seemed to have just wanted money, you know, because they thought we were rich. But then once we got to know them, you know, or got a chance to really talk with them and stuff, you know, we dispelled that. And so the thing all have to realize that there have been stories told about us to them and likewise. So we grew up thinking certain things about our brothers and sisters on the continent, and likewise they did too, the things that were erroneous. So those of us who care need to do whatever we can do to dispel all of that. And that's kind of like what we did on our trip. We talked a lot. We had really good conversations and talked about things that they thought and things that they were finding out, you know, that, you know, they were just surprised to hear certain things. And likewise, because we thought that them being in their own country should have been more politically ready, I should say, for lack of a better term. But we found out that they were not, you know, and so, you know, we kind of educated each other and found out that a lot of them were thinking globally, just like some of us were thinking globally. So, you know, I think that we have a lot more in common than we know or acknowledge, because we all have deficits, and then we all have, you know, some positive stuff going on. But, you know, we just need to be able to get together on it.
Yeah, a concept that I love to often forward or just have people, in a sense, give thought to. Again, we are the Mental Dialogue Talk Show, where our motto is all I ask is that you think. Michelle, is the idea of there's always this concept of, quote unquote, the wealth gap in the country between black people and or the different demographics, as you will, the significant wealth gap. And so a thought that and we've actually had guests on from different parts of the continents, bridging gaps for them to do business with each other. But I always like to highlight that as much as I am an advocate for reparations for the African American community, I think they are very necessary. As much as I'm an advocate for it, I'm also a realist in the sense of you still do everything that you can until that date, if it ever even comes about, right? So you have to still do everything you can. And so without an influx that, again, I feel like our community deserves personally, that's, again, you can feel different, or you can call in and give your thoughts about this. But even with me personally feeling that way, the one thing that I highlight, without that influx, if you will, from the government, one of the biggest mistakes I think we can make is to constantly chase the old money that is already foundationally wrapped up in, if you will, the majority culture because of the history of this country. And so now that the world is becoming global, one of the most immediate opportunities to get a new influx of wealth is to bridge the gap between us and various brothers and sisters, in particularly on the continent of Africa or even down in the Caribbean, that are doing their own thing. And I know so even some of our members that are absolutely doing what I am suggesting, but I don't know that it's been said enough or even thought about. It's almost like we keep chasing this old money. You cannot close the gap when that's already wrapped up. But if you bring in an influx of money from across other parts of the world, you can set yourself up just fine. Again, just something that I like to throw out there. Your thoughts on hearing that, Queen?
I guess I have my energies are kind of different. My energies are toward us doing for self, us lifting us, and to do to create an economic situation that's where money is reoccurring in our own neighborhoods, in our own communities. That takes some time and takes some work, but that's what we're working on. I mean, I don't discount anything that's going to uplift our people. My position has, from as long as I can remember, has been that our struggle has to be fought on every level. And if that's what you think and that's where you're at, I respect it and I can support it. And I think that anytime you've got a good idea, and a good idea is very precious, so you need to work on it and make it happen. So that's what I want to do, is work on us, lifting us. And creating a situation where we're being able to have some control over our money and speak a little bit more intelligently about that.
No, I definitely respect that. I was actually referring to, I'm sorry, I kind of went long-winded with it. I was actually asking, if you will, Shay, your thoughts on the concept of us bridging the gap with our brothers and sisters to kind of generate some money amongst that bridge while in a fist. Like, that's a thought that I don't know that's floated out there enough. Again, I have some people who are actually doing it. And so I was just kind of, I wanted to hear Shay's thoughts on that. You know, in a sense, for us in the current generations who are trying to make these economic leaps, we're always chasing the bag here in the States. And I'm saying there's global money, and why not chase it with our brothers and sisters over in Africa, was my thought. And I just wanted to hear Shay's thoughts on that concept from her perspective.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I think you're spot on. And it's more not even to chase it, but to create it, because there's so many different ways. Now that we are in a global society and those that, you know, recognize one another as family, as having some type of, like Mom said, do for self, we can do this together. We don't necessarily, I don't think we need to wait. You know, if reparations come, like you say, in whatever form that makes sense, then great. Right. But we have so much opportunity to get together and create that wealth. And I think it's also it's getting together and getting with our brothers and sisters that are on the continent, going to the continent, finding out the different opportunities, really like doing your research. But it also comes down to changing our mindset around what we do with those resources, because there are so many ways. You know, for us to build wealth. So it's more so, you know, now that you found this way, are you still going to rely on, like I said earlier, that external thinking? You need more. I need more things. I need to have this certain car, this certain house. Like all of that is so wasteful, and it's so directed at us that even as we find these new ways to work together, if that's still your way of thinking, you know, about spending money instead of using it as a tool and as a resource, then it's still going to be a huge deficit. So I think it's those two things you highlighted, that coming together with those different opportunities, but really thinking about the best way to use those resources that they're created.
Now, I love that you pointed that out. Again, we've had dialogue specifically about bridging that gap, and something you just highlighted, that consumerism that is bred in all of America, not just even us as African Americans, but like you said, a lot of stuff directed at us. But to your point, as much as even what I'm saying in a sense could be considered a good idea, and again, having done full-out shows on it, one piece of cautionary tale is, okay, yeah, there may be an opportunity, let's say, in a Kenya, if you will, but I had the sister on, Tamika People, who has Seize to Shirt, and so she is the first black owned textile manufacturer in the country since 1908, and so with Seize to Shirt, she's very conscious of not wanting, she's bridging the gap, wanting to have the cotton actually originate from Africa. She works with cotton farmers here in the black cotton farmers here in the United States. But she's also talked about on that show being very conscious of the fact that she did not want to enter her relationship with the brothers and sisters on the continent from a strictly American capitalistic opportunist viewpoint. She's been burned by that many times. So Shay, I appreciate, like you said, that thought that, yeah, let's make sure there's an opportunity, but she wanted to do it. And there's a term that she used, and I wish I could remember it right now. But again, it's just, when you said that, Shay, it reminded me to say, yes, let's make sure we are looking for the money around the world. Yes, let's do it with our brothers and sisters over in the continent of Africa, but let's be conscious of that relationship so we bridge the gap in a way that is beneficial to both and not just simply exploitive. So good point, Shay. Let's go to this break. When we come back, we're going to get into the inevitable night that created 1148 Lewis Street. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show, where all I ask is that you think.
For details to become a sponsor of Mental Dialogue, visit Facebook at Mental Dialogue or call Montoya Smith at 404-604-9477. That's 404-604-9477. Mental Dialogue, where all I ask is that you think, that you think, that you think.
Welcome back to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show. I'm your host, Montoya Smith, a.k.a. Black Socrates. We're always looking for sponsors to support this unique brand of radio. We're not relying on YouTube views, if you will. We do require your support. So if you want to support as an individual, go to mentaldialogue.com and become a member. And again, if you have a product or service you would like to get out, please consider sponsoring and keeping Smart Radio on the air. Our special guest this morning, Mama Tamu and Shay, for this morning's discussion question, Married to the Revolution, who is Mama Tamu? And we're going to get into the infamous night of why this book is called 1148 Lewis Street. And he basically said, just before dawn on August 18th, 1971, we were awakened by a loud, unidentified voice speaking through a bullhorn and demanding that we all exit the house. Suddenly and without warning, a barrage of bullets and tear gas canisters pierced the silence and peace of the morning that we so enjoyed only seconds prior. According to police and FBI reports, we were allowed only 75 seconds to wake up, get dressed, and exit the house before bullets and tear gas canisters were fired. Akima and I jumped out of bed. I grabbed a spring coat that I had brought with me. I did not have time to get dressed or get my shoes. Akima was able to get his pants on, but no shirt and no shoes. Bullets and tear gas poured into a small wood frame house. There was an exchange of gunfire. While we were nonviolent, we did believe in self-defense. Sister Najiri Quadus, who happened to be pregnant, and I were the only two female occupants. The moment was chaotic as the room filled with tear gas canisters and bullets flying, glass breaking, plaster fell from the ceilings and wall, and everyone just out of bed grabbing any clothing they could. It was like a horror film. We had no idea who was shooting us at us, possibly the KKK or some other white hate group whose terroristic activities against black people were still prevalent and against our mission and goal of black nationhood. None of us had warrants. Police had no prior information relative to arms violation at Republic of New African facilities. We had broken no laws. Our singular reality was that we had been unjustifiably assaulted. Mama Tamu, when you hear that, again, just your thoughts, Queen, again, just speak to what you just... You woke up to, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, it was totally wild. I mean, like, you couldn't even accept what was going on because it was so out of the ordinary, you know, to have something like that happen to you. These are the kind of things you see maybe in movies or to have somebody talk about it or tell you about it, but to have it actually happen with you is you know, quite devastating and messing with your mind. It was, you know, quite an experience to go through all that and just to see, you know, glass flying over your head and to see plaster falling from the walls, you know, and it's just the room looked like full of smoke, but I guess that was from all the dust and stuff from, you know, when the plaster was falling and all that, I guess, but it was just an array of like a storm in there, but yeah, we got through it, but as I said in the book, young Chuma, who was only 17 years old at the time, got myself and the other sister got us out of the house into a tunnel that they had prepared previously and got us, you know, out through a hole in the closet floor. And they got us, he got us out of there. But, you know, but it was still, your mind is just like gone. Like, what is going on? And the gunfire is going both ways by this time. So it was just a big craziness.
Now, I can only imagine. Let me give context for anybody out there listening. And so, you know, we're now aware of, you know, some of the history, if you will, of the Black Power movement, and you think of the Black Panthers and unfortunately often being in various shootouts, and we now understand, if you will, COINTELPRO and what they did to divide the Black Panthers, if you will. But the context that I want to provide for someone listening, in a sense, maybe hearing that, hey, you were part of the Republic of New Africa and maybe making some assumptions here. And so what I want to be clear, the context for this unfortunate night for Mama Tumu and her comrades, if you will, was at this point, we're not talking about, if you will, a recognized group that had been even put in the media as some type of violent group or anything. You were talking about, as she said, a group that believed in land ownership and the defense of that land, so they naturally exhibited their right to bear arms, if you will, to protect themselves. But this night, as she said, was literally out of the blue, with not having past run-ins with anyone in law enforcement or the FBI, from what I understand, as you said, out of the blue, from nowhere, and if I recall from the book correctly, it was a trip that you hadn't long taken because you were originally from Wisconsin and not too long after the trip you had taken there. And I want to move into the marriage to the revolution part, if you will. Again, I just wanted to give the context of, we are talking to, if you will, I would say a real life revolutionary who had that experience. But I want to highlight, if I recall correctly from the book, that this day changed the path with you and Hakima, your husband, because prior to this, you know, there was consideration for separation, but after this day happened, that would never be the case, because this day that we just spoke about tied you, in my opinion, forever to the revolution, and you stayed committed to helping your husband, who was later convicted for life based on an incident of having done nothing wrong, woking up to gunfire out of nowhere, and due to a return of fire, cop did lose his life, and in a sense, y'all were all charged with that murder, and Hakima smartly coming up with a way for you not to be charged, and you were free, and again, big respects for that level of preparation. I'm also personally blown away by the preparation to the extent that y'all even had a tunnel that day to escape, because maybe I wouldn't be talking to you if that level of preparation was not there. So big up for being that forward thinking to the Republic of New Africa. Again, that's just a personal big up I want to give you and Brother Hakima and all the brothers a part of you, New Af- the Republic of New Africa for being that prepared, even though they had not come to Mississippi to cause any issue. You just wanted to purchase land. So again, I gave a lot of context, but if you could speak specifically to how that day tied you and Hakima, because again, you, if I remember, you were on the verge of possibly even divorce prior to this day. So any thoughts on that
right.
part?
Yeah, after my trip to Africa, and upon my return, you know, there were we were having problems before I even went to Africa. But once I got back, you know, the problems did not change, and we were going to split up. But we had planned this trip. We had planned to go to Mississippi when I returned, and so, you know, we followed through with that and went to Mississippi. And then, you know, being there for the second night is when, you know, when things happened early that morning, the following morning, is when the shootout occurred. And then we were all arrested in that house. There were 7 people in that house. And then a couple blocks away, there were 4 brothers and sisters, 1 sister and 3 brothers at the other government center where they were up and doing government work. And when they were told to come out of the house, well, they were already dressed and everything, and they just came out and asked, you know, what do you want? You know, because nobody was wanted for anything. But so there was a conversation took place, and then they were handcuffed and, you know, brought to jail like the rest of us were. So we were, those of us on Lewis Street, after the shooting, well, first let me back up a little bit. When Chuma got the sister and I into the tunnel, shortly after that, the other brothers came down as well, and the shooting continued. And then Hakima saw that they were uniformed police officers, so he told them, the others, let's you know, hold our fire.
Mm-hmm.
So we yelled that we were coming out to hold their fire. And we did, and fortunately, they did hold their fire because,
mm-hmm.
you know, heaven knows that they could have killed us and gotten away with it, even though we were asking them, you know, to hold their fire. Well, anyway, we got out, and they had us laying on the ground and interrogating us and hitting the brush with the gun, with their guns and stuff. And then... Then they, you know, had us all handcuffed and took us to the front, had us sitting down on the curb while they called for the police van. And incidentally, there was about 35 police and FBI agents surrounding our house. And there was, they clearly came for war. They had, the police vests, bulletproof vest
and everything. Yeah, they absolutely came with an ongoing onslaught prepared again for, you know, you who had done nothing, had no transgression. And so, if you don't mind, Mama Tamu, I would love to move to your thought process to getting to saying I'm sticking with him, based on having the prior problems after this tumultuous day. I want to kind of hear, if you will, your mindset as, if you will, the wife of getting into the mindset, having had to, unfortunately, a jail stay yourself. And like I said, smartly able to get you out of jail through, again, a very smart approach by Hakima and the brothers or whatever. But again, I want them to read the book for those details. I'm curious at your withdrawal, because this is how our generation looks at the two of you. And Shay's talked about this, like your willingness to stick together through everything that y'all had been through. And not, when I say everything, not only this tumultuous night of being ambushed by police and the FBI, but actually your husband gets convicted for life. And
yeah.
I want to hear your Mama Tamu's thought process to saying, I'm sticking with him, because I don't think the average person can do that. I want to hear Dell's thought process more than the details. They can read the book for the details. I want to hear your thoughts behind what made you have that type of fortitude, Queen.
He had life on the state level plus 15 years on the federal level. But anyhow, created when you're in that kind of group, if you will, there's a certain dedication that, and it's an undergirth that the movement provides for relationships, for personal relationships. It's, you know how people in church, when they say equally yoked and all that stuff,
mm-hmm.
when you're in the same, yeah, well, so it's sort of something like that. It's an undergirth that helps to hold relationships together when you've committed yourself to that same kind of, and so that's part of it. You don't just turn and walk away. Now, I'm not suggesting that was the only way, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, I could have been supportive and gone ahead and had my life in a different direction once I got out, you know. But again, you know, of course, I was in love as well. And so it was like, it was a no-brainer for me. I didn't think about it. Some people ask, what made me make those decisions that I make? And I'm like, nothing. It was just, that was just the natural order of things. I never sat down and thought about it and said, well, you know, I'm going to stick with this man. I'm going to have children. I didn't think about it like that. It just happened. It just was the way things were. In my head, I never, ever thought that he would be locked up for the rest of his life. It just wasn't. I never accepted that. So,
Shay, I'm curious. Any thoughts to your mom? And, you probably ask her questions about it yourself, but let's do it live on the air for the people listening. Just you're here based on your mom's resilience and, as she just said, belief that your father would not be locked up for life despite receiving a life sentence. Most people can't have that faith, and most people definitely wouldn't go visit their locked up husband to create children to include you, if you will. So I'm curious, do you have any questions for your mom, as the special guest on this show?
I do have a question for you, Mom, but I wanna say this first. I spoke about this earlier when I talked about finding your mate in the work. And
mm-hmm.
like I said, this is a great example of that. But the way she said she didn't even think about it, it was what it was. She didn't see him staying.
Mm-hmm.
He had life and he had 15 years on top of that. She
right.
didn't even think, oh, he's going to be in prison for life, or I'm creating a family with someone that I'll always be away from. I can only visit him. She didn't even see him staying in there for life. That part, in my opinion, has so much to do with who she is as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And I said this a moment ago, and a lot of people won't catch on to this, but I really, really want to interject this. There's something called inside versus external referral. And when you really, really, really know who you are, and that takes time. For some, you know, it just depends on the environment you grow up in, the nurturing or not nurturing. Sometimes will you know, force people to figure out who they are.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that anybody listening, really take that away, because the idea of romantic love, the idea of gifts, the ideas of walks in the park, the ideas of, that picturesque kind of love. I think so many people long for that, and even if you get it, if it's not substance there, if you don't know who you are and are equally yoked, like Mom said, you're attracted to who you are. When you know who you are and you have the same type of energy, the same elements that make you who you are, and you can really see someone else and you're conscious and you're clear, these are the types of things that I feel form these bonds. You really have to rely on yourself internally and know who you are to be able to match up and create impact like this. There are countless people who have been impacted by their story, by their love. And so one of the things that I thought to ask you, Mom, I would love to hear this from you. I've never asked you this, is what was your self-talk like? If you can recall anything, like when you sat by yourself, when you had those internal conversations with yourself about keeping it moving, being positive, whatever that was, what kind of self-talk was that, if you can remember?
Well, if I understand you correctly, my thoughts when I left the jail, I was interviewed, and I remember one thing that I said was that I would leave no stone unturned until all the brothers were free. And I meant that from the bottom of my heart, my entire soul. And when I left, I carried that with me. And that spirit that I had was not just for, you know, all the brothers. It was also for my personal life as well. So I didn't sit and think separately. I had a job to do. My job was to work towards freeing the brothers and make situations where it came and I as palatable as possible, and creating. And it was at a point that I decided that I did want to go ahead and have children, but it wasn't like I sat down and thought about it that day. I've always wanted children. I've always wanted children. I was always so in love with my nephews and nieces, and I did want kids of my own. So I'm like, hey, you know, the clock is ticking. I better do something. So, you know, so of course I went ahead to, and we began to try to have children, and kept on till we had three. So, but I don't know if I'm answering your question.
You did. Okay. And I just want to repeat it for everybody, because, you know, it's one thing for us to listen to our elders or to listen to other people's stories and be intrigued, but you want to walk away with, how do I apply this in my life? Is this applicable in a way to me? And I think you said that you didn't sit and think about it. It was in you all the way down to your soul. So like I said, when we refer on our internal referral and we follow who we really are, things are create. That's when you create life. You're not just living life. You literally are creating based on who you are. And so we're all gifted from even from your self-talk. So anyway, I just wanted to ask that question because I never have.
Yeah, amazing question. Great question. And I love your response, Mama Tamu. And I wanted to share, speaking of, as you said, deciding, I'm still amazed outside looking in. And I think as the average person would be, say, you know, I'm going to make these babies with this man who has a life sentence. Again, love the fact that your belief that he would never stay locked up is what that decision and that belief is probably what led to the freedom that he has to this day and your fortitude. So, again, credit to you. But I wanted to highlight a moment that's fearful for you, as you mentioned in the book. So I'm going to share a longer passage than I've shared most of the show. But I just want to hear your thoughts to this, because and I'll tell you what it made me think after I finished reading. His demeanor changed quite abruptly. He walked briskly over to my cell, asking in a loud and demanding tone, "Why didn't you tell me you were getting out tomorrow?" Stunned by his sudden change of behavior, I said nothing. This was new. He had never displayed any level of hostility to any of us before, and I couldn't understand why it would matter that I didn't tell him I was leaving. It wasn't like we were best friends or anything, and it wasn't his business when I was leaving. He exited the cell block and slammed the door. We were all so unnerved by his behavior. The sister who had revealed that I was leaving felt that she had spoken inappropriately and repeatedly apologized. Minutes later, the jailer and trustee returned. Neither said anything to the other sisters. They rapidly stormed all the way to my cell and opened the door and ordered me to get out. I don't know if I ever felt as fearful as I did at that moment, but I obeyed. I remember glancing at the trustee in appeal for his assistance or intervention, but he just looked at me grinning with amusement. As I passed the other sisters in their cells, their faces were all pressed against the bars, looking as full of fear as I was and probably feeling guilty for having told the jailer that I was leaving. The jailer, trustee, and I entered the cell block. I could only imagine what they were that they were about to rape me, kill me, or both. Approaching another jail cell across from my cell block, the jailer, in a harsh and forceful manner, said to me, "If you ever tell anybody about this, I will kill you and your husband." He pushed me into the cell, and there stood Hakima. We were both so shaken that all we could do was hug each other in a tight embrace. Hakima's experience was comparable to my own. With no idea where he was being taken in the middle of the night, unofficially, unassured of his fate, one can only think it is to do bodily harm. While a grand gesture on the part of the jailer, I only wish he would not have scared us so much. The jailer told us, "Y'all hurry up, do what you can do. You ain't got much time because we gonna be changing shifts pretty soon." We were both so unnerved, all we could do was hold each other. We certainly were not comfortable with taking things any further. The precious and unexpected moment of just being together was a real treat. Go ahead, Queen.
No, I was just kind of reflecting back. That was such a scary, scary situation. The drama of it was just like what you would see, you know, in an old movie or something, that they take you out and hang you or something.
Right. Yeah, and this is what I wrote when I read that for the first time. And again, it's just something that I highlight. I wrote the word humans because these jailers, and just again, it's just kind of pointing out the thought process. These are some white jailers. You're in the middle of the South. They took this huge risk. And like you said, the way he's coming at you, it's like he's upset because you're actually getting to leave the jail, and that's how he's acting. Yeah. And he's like, "Why didn't you tell me?" And then he wants, in his mind, offer a deed. He doesn't know that the emotion of it made you, as you said, too fearful to go in any further than y'all went, other than to hug each other. But even amongst the most tumultuous situations, it's always amazing who will be the person who will sometimes reach out to help you. And that's what made me write the word humans. That was just an amazing moment to me. I don't know if you want to give any other thoughts, and we got a couple of minutes. We might have to go to break before I get Shay's thoughts on it. But I just wanted to kind of hear your thoughts, because that's what it made me write. It made me write the word. I literally wrote it in my book, Humans.
You're right. I think that was appropriate to write that, Humans.
Mm-hmm. Shay, any thoughts? We got about a minute before break.
No, I agree. I agree with that. You know, we talk about being race first, and that's really, really important. But, you know, sometimes you never know where kindness is going to come from or compassion is going to come from.
Absolutely. So, you know, it's just something that I think we always have to remember, even as we're trying to figure this out, you know, even from within our culture. I think it's just something that we, in a sense, have to be aware of what human nature can be. That somebody can relate to your story and say, "You know what, I'm going to help, because even though I don't have the power to, you know, in a sense, do anything about them being wrongfully jailed,
Right.
I'm willing to help along the way. And again, sometimes you never know, in a sense, where that help is going to come from. So I just thought it was something worthy of highlighting. And for this last segment, again, I hope we've intrigued for those listening to go out and get 1148 Lewis Street, A Long Journey, so they can get more details of actually what you went through. And again, while that guy was trying to set up, in a sense, a visit, go ahead and do what you want to do, if you will, a conjugal visit at that time. Again, you didn't know where things were going to go. You stayed with Hakeema after the night, August 18th, 1971. Y'all were on the verge of divorce, if you will, and that moment tied y'all together forever, and you decided, I'm going to have children with this man via visits from Wisconsin all the way to Mississippi. You eventually moved close and made a family with him, and eventually he was let out. You can read the book for more of that story. When we come back from break, I'm going to play this cut to talk about how you see relationships in your time and what's happening today. So when I play this cut, it's going to be completely unrelated to your book, but I think you will have some things that we can learn from Mama Tumu when you hear this cut. So after the commercial, you're going to hear this cut, and I want to hear your thoughts after this commercial. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show, where all I ask is that you think.
Are you intimidated by money? While this is a question most people never think to ask themselves, but when forced to think about it, many people realize they have unrecognized fears that truly affect how they deal with money. If you want to learn more about money and the fears that keep you from prosperity, join us for Making Money Matter Monday, where money meets mental health with personal finance coach Ashley Thomas and psychotherapist Dr. Katrina Pitts. Every second Monday of the month, find out if you're intimidated by money and what to do about it. To receive a link to this free Zoom event, please DM the Making Money Matter or the Mental Dialogue Instagram pages or contact 404-604-9477.
The reason you know who I am was because of Eric. I would still be a lawyer in Cleveland absent him. What we managed to do was to take what I was good at and to take what he was good at and combine them and become this better thing. I was a lawyer who hated practicing law. I had an opportunity to run for judge. I had no business winning that race, but my husband did not know how to lose. We almost got a divorce. I want you to do 5 more houses tonight. You need to do 10 more houses. You need to get out there. You need to get out there. We were fighting and arguing and every day. More, more, more. I won by 6 votes. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
He couldn't have done it without me. I couldn't have done it without him.
Yes. So every great thing that you accomplished, he was the wind beneath your wings.
Absolutely. No doubt about it.
Welcome back to the Mental Dialogue Talk Show. I'm your host, Montoya Smith, a.k.a. Black Socrates. This morning's discussion question, married to the revolution, who is Mama Tumu? And we're fortunate to have on Mama Tumu Kanyama, as well as her daughter, Shay. And I just played a cut, just hopefully you're familiar with Judge Lynn. That voice pretty much stands out anywhere. She's obviously famous on TV now, being a judge on TV, if you will. But that was her on the Dear Future Wifey podcast, highlighting, in a sense, the role her husband played in her moving from being, if you will, a lawyer that hated doing, you know, law. And now we know her, and she's crediting that relationship between her and her husband. So when I saw that cut, that is what we wonder, if you will, Mama Tumu, how long have you been married to Brother Hakeema now, and what stands out to you in her conversation, and how does it even relate to you and Brother Hakeema, because I'm assuming there's some similarities there. Go ahead, Queen.
Well, we've been married for 53 years, and in October we'll be 54. Okay, but yeah, I can see that cut. that you just played, you know, the support, it does. The togetherness, I like that.
Shay, anything? I got another question for her, but I want to make sure I let you jump in before I ask another question. Anything that, again, I don't, again, it's just for me, I think it's the opportunity for us to learn from someone who's, as she just said, married 43, about to be 50, I mean 53, about to be 54 years. It's an opportunity for us. Again, they are always propped up, her and Brother Akima, for being able to stick together and have a family and have, you know, you, a beautiful queen yourself. And it's just an opportunity to learn from them. And so I thought that cut reminded me of, let's take advantage of that opportunity on this show, if you will. So anything for your mom? Again, I have another question for her, but I just want to make sure I let you jump in as well.
No, I'll just say this quickly. In their relationship, my parents' relationship, and with the judge and her husband, you heard a certain level of unselfishness, a certain level of seeing the other person. I think many times we can go into situations with a very selfish eye, and you hear, no, it was a struggle, but we didn't walk away, and it's because they saw something different.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, and so my question for you, Mama, to move to build on this is, again, you've been an educator. You talked about even, you know, seeing relationships and marriages of, you know, brothers from and sisters from the States with brothers in Africa and things of that nature. But from your own experience, what would you share that you think is lacking for us as younger, you know, just currently, for people that are looking to have something as strong and as long as lasting as you and Brother Akima, just from your perspective, what might you offer, or what do you think is missing, or what is it that we don't understand? Really, just anything that you can offer. Again, I think it's an opportunity to learn from.
I think number one, I think it's very helpful, almost essential, to have something that binds you more than the love, because different things can test your love, let me tell you. So you have to have something, like I say, it's an undergirth, something that holds you up when you fall out with each other. So you got to have something there, and that you both are committed to. I think that also people tend to throw in the towel too quickly. And that is not to say that you in a relationship where something is toxic, that you don't stay there, you know, and deal with the toxicity of it. But I'm just saying, sometimes people throw in the towel too soon. You know, you got to struggle with it for a while. It's not the easiest thing to live and be with a person who's totally different than you. You know, y'all were two different people, two different households, et cetera, and came together. So you have a lot of things that are different, even though you have things in common. But, you know, you have to work through some of those things. And the last thing I want to say is that when there are problems in a relationship, they may be big, they may be small, but you don't just get back together, you know, fall out and then just get back together. Resolve it. If you don't resolve the issues, particularly if issues are deep, you don't know how deep they are with one person. It may be nothing to you, but it could be something very serious to the other person. So I'm saying always try and resolve your issues, because issues that are unresolved will find a way to come back up at some point, and that can destroy your relationship.
Now, it makes sense. And then, again, let me jump to, I'm not going to read from the book, but I think another thing that relates to what we're talking about from your book, and I think here's another learning opportunity, in my opinion, because if I recall correctly, I always highlight, I think it was, Brother Akima ended up being in prison for 9 years, if I remember right. Is that okay, cool. I just want to make sure I always have that right. So one thing you talked about in the book was, in a sense, while y'all had built, you had specifically built a routine, again, having the children while he was in prison during that time, if you will, but you had built a routine of how you were taking care of the children. And you talked about when he, you know, finally gets out. Again, go read the book. highlight 1148 Lewis Street, A Long Journey. Go get the book. But you highlight when he gets out, how difficult it actually became when he, in a sense, came back in the household, wanted to kind of insert himself, quote, if you will, naturally as the man, and how difficult that was because of one, you had a routine, and now he's trying to figure that out as well. And you said that was very difficult. So if you could kind of even speak to that time, because I think there's a lot that we can learn with that male-female dynamic that y'all had to figure out under really, I would say, tougher circumstances than even the average couple, if you will. So just what, how did y'all even figure that out, Mama Tamu?
I don't even know if we did. but it's, you know, there was this thing that he, you know, because you got your head set one way. You know, I'm dreaming and thinking of how things are going to be when he gets home. And when he gets there, you know, and he's complaining about stuff. And I'm like, what the hell? You know, he's just thinking he should be so happy. Why you complain about anything? But and again, it was basically how I was raising the children. The fact that, and I mentioned in the book and that they can have that many black books, and I'm spending all my money on the airline going back and forth to you. I have so much final black books, so. You know, different things like that I just, so ungrateful. I was just taken aback. I couldn't believe. I'm like, what we got here? What we going to do?
Hey, you could have stuck through the 9 years and left them just because of that, Mama Tamu.
Hey, sure.
Hey, that's what we doing in 2024.
Yeah.
So Shay, am I right? We need some secrets. She still ain't giving us the secret sauce.
Well, have to make a decision. You have to make a decision, you know, am I gonna stay or am I gonna go? Let me see what this is gonna, as they say, I'm gonna stay and see what the end gonna bring.
Yeah, she really is giving it up. It's like, again, and I know I sound like a broken record, I probably said it three or four times. But honestly, You really just got to know you, I think. I don't think there is like a secret sauce that you can really point to say, yep, that's it, I'm grabbing that, because you got to figure out what it is for you. You know, like she said, making that decision, like, who are you to make certain types of decisions? So, you know, and then like she said, she still doesn't know if they ever figured it out, but because of what their love created, you know what I mean? This is life, and it's not always going to be pretty.
Right. So,
yeah,
so there's no magic in it, in relationships. There's no magic in it. You know, you decide what you're going to do. There were times when I did feel like, you know, saying the heck with this, you know, after all these years and blah, 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 you know, let me get out of here. But
Yep, here's a big question with 2 minutes to go. Just personal opinion, has it been worth it? And I'm not talking about simply the marriage. I'm talking about everything, the whole journey of being married to the movement almost being playing a role in you and together. Has it been worth it from your perspective, Queen?
I think so. I believe that it has. I could not imagine my life any other way. I can't imagine living another way other than, you know, being involved in the movement and, you know, with the relationship that we have. I wouldn't know what to do with myself in another situation.
No, I love it. And so for anybody out there, 1148 Lewis Street, A Long Journey, you can go on Amazon and pick up the book to get even more details to some of the things you heard. Again, today's discussion, Married to the Revolution. So pleased to have on Mama Tamu. I think we have figured out who you are, where that dedication and fortitude comes from. It was born in your DNA, as you highlighted your grandmother growing up in the late being born in the late 1800s and being a part of you. So just wanted to highlight that. Shay, thank you for being on with us. I also want to highlight, Shay, that you will be on our next Making Money Matter Mondays, which is where money and mental health meets, as we continue to discuss basically finances for our elderly family that we may have to take care of with as well. So just want to thank you for being a part of this show and going forward for being a part of Making Money Matters in May, if you will. So thank both of you for being on. We are at the end of our time, and maybe we can do this again in the future. See y'all next Saturday. All I ask is that you think.
Thank you.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution is delivering the news of today. From podcasts to original series to unmatched sports coverage, we do it for everyone who is here to work, live, and play. We do it for the greater Atlanta. Subscribe now at AJC.com.
Hey, guys, time to get in on the action for the biggest moments in basketball with Prize Picks, America's number one fantasy sports app. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projections, place your entry, and win up to 100 times your money. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit of up to $100. Just download the Prize Picks app and use the code GET100. That's code GET100 on Prize Picks for a first deposit match of up to $100. Prize Picks. Pick more. Pick less. It's that easy.